Welcome back, mates, to this episode of the podcast. Today with the guest was a man by the name of Jordan Schneider. He's the host of the China Talk podcast and also the China Talk newsletter, which, if you are interested in China, is just the most terrific source of information. Jordan is also currently the senior analyst at the Rhodium Group, where he focuses on tech in China, its rise, international implications, geopolitical relations, and all the various and myriad applications of tech in China. Super, super fascinating subject of interest. This episode was a broad chat where I'm afraid I probably served my own interests more than I did make the most of the wealth of knowledge that came in the form of this guest. I spent a lot of the time asking him about his time at Bridgewater and speech writing rather than his sort of core focus and competencies these days relating to China. But he did clarify something which I think is really important, and that's what communism means in the Chinese Communist Party. It was something that I'd wondered about for quite a while. How are we supposed to think about what communism means in the context of the Chinese Communist Party? How different is it, say, from the communism of the Soviet Union or of Cuba or of North Korea? Because as Jordan kind of corrects, I was thinking in my head that they were drastically different, and there was in fact not much overlap between the differences, despite the fact that the name communism would be synonymously used throughout. But we spoke about those three things rather than maybe questions about Tencent or Chinese innovation, the police state and so forth, these sort of matters. Definitely go and subscribe to his podcast and look at his newsletter if you are interested in that stuff, because like I said, terrific source of information. If the police state or the Uyghur Muslims in China is particularly interesting to you, go back to episode 37 that I did with Jeffrey Kane, who wrote a book called The Perfect Police State, where he conducts a first-hand investigation into those specific issues. But thank you so much, Jordan, for giving me some of your time. It was really fun to speak with you. In the podcast, you can expect to hear about the following. Some of the minutiae about podcasting, asking questions, when to interrupt, etc. Jordan's experience working at Bridgewater, one of the most famous hedge funds in the world, run by Ray Dalio, and a company who's notoriously hard to get into and known for having this unreal radical honesty policy. So Jordan actually unpacks what the radical honesty policy might look like in the day-to-day. And then as well, Jordan explains the communist roots of the CCP. So check out the timestamps to navigate your way through the chat. Hang around to the end to hear my afterthoughts and ambition for this podcast as a whole. And obviously subscribe to Jordan's podcast. And then with no further ado, here he is, Mr. Jordan Schneider. Jordan, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me, mate.
My pleasure.
And you're coming at us from a New York afternoon, I believe.
Yes, sir.
Beautiful. When did you leave Beijing?
So I was in China in Chinese New Year of 2020, so late January. I took what was supposed to be a seven-day vacation to Malaysia to go scuba diving. And I never made it back. So that was when COVID broke out and I canceled my flight back thinking, not sure I want to fly right into a pandemic, back when that was the only place we had a pandemic. Ended up sort of bopping around a little bit in Asia, showed up in New York, March 2020. And a month later, China had closed its borders to foreigners. So I've been here ever since.
What about all your stuff? Did you get that handled?
The stuff is now, the stuff took like 4 months via boat. There was a certain point I was like, okay, I guess I'm probably not going back anytime soon. And then I got it packed up and sent over.
That must have been an absolute headache of admin sorting out that without having to be there, just letting someone into the apartment, something so as simple as that.
I mean, shout out to my wife who took the brunt of that. I mean, there was a moment where we were Zooming with, or the equivalent of Zooming with, like a company that was like putting all our stuff into boxes at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I stayed up for like 30 minutes of it, and she soldiered on and told them which, you know, plates we did and didn't want and whatnot. So nice. don't want to take too much credit for that.
Yeah, well, I guess you had someone there, so that makes it easy. Obviously, you're known as, I guess, more or less the China guy. I don't want to brand you as the China guy, but you host China Talk and because of that, obviously, that's what I would like to speak to you about quite a bit. But before that, there was something in your resume that stood out to me as being just fascinating and exciting, something really interesting. And so I was hoping you'd be able to talk to me about speeching, about writing speeches in Chile for the U.S. Department of State.
A deep cut. Oh, my God. I mean, I was like 20 years old. You know, I was an intern in college, let's be clear. It was a fascinating experience. I mean, like, you know, they didn't have me do anything important. There was like the ambassador was going to go to like talk at a high school one day. And they're like, Jordan, do you want to, you know, write three paragraphs for us? So that was the extent of it. I will say about that experience, I think the third day I was there, which was like a Wednesday morning, the consular office, the most senior like consular person, crashed his car at 3 o'clock in the morning on a Wednesday morning. And that was like in the newspaper. And that kind of set the tone for the summer, I guess. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, it was a fascinating experience. I feel like really sad that my Spanish is kind of like all the Chinese words have like taken precedence over the Spanish words, such that like I can still hear, I can still like comprehend Spanish pretty mm-hmm. well, but like having the words come out is a real real challenge. It was funny. I spent like a month or so in Mexico after I got my vaccine, and like slowly squeezing those Spanish words out of me was a real pain, having gone from like, you know, pretty close to fluent to speaking like a 4-year-old was a bit of a bummer.
No, man, that's a massive bummer. I can only imagine the sort of disappointment you'd have in that. So those I just assume you would be writing in English, but so those paragraphs you wrote were in Spanish.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
This is 13 years ago now, but yeah, again, it was like, you know, it's great to see you here all today. You know, this is maybe you want to cut this entire section. There really isn't a ton there.
It wasn't a sophisticated sort of policy cultural interface.
Oh no, this was the like, we don't want to have Jordan. Maybe I'll just take, I should take this. I already find this on my LinkedIn. I should probably take this down at this point. nothing super fancy. I mean, it was like, what other stories can I tell from that time? Like,
of course.
I was there. Chile made like a World Cup run. I think that was the real highlight, is being this like really, I'm kind of tall. And so like, I would go to all these events where they would like watch the games in the Palacio or whatever. And, I just like would stick out because I'm A, wearing a suit, and B, just like this like white dude with like big frizzy hair, and just like cheering really loudly for Chile. They lost to Brazil in the quarterfinals, I think. It was tragic.
Well, even though I might have overestimated the role and the significance of your speeches, I think it still nonetheless would inform the point of the question that I wanted to ask, which was whether there was a link between speechwriters and podcasting. And I ask this because it could just be confirmation bias on my end, but yourself, Peter Robinson, who hosts Uncommon Knowledge, I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. If you're not, he's fantastic. He's interviewed everyone going back to the early 90s. And I kind of mean everyone, every significant cultural person. He has sat across the table from them at some point. It's kind of a shame that he hasn't transitioned the same success into podcasting, although he still does podcasting. And then finally, a compatriot of mine, one of the best podcasts out there, called The Jolly Swagman by a host called Joe Walker. He's also a speechwriter. So I put yourself in this list, but yourself, Peter Robertson, and Joe Walker are oral speechwriters. And in my regular life, it's not like I'm coming across many speechwriters, right? So I was thinking, is there some link between speechwriters and then podcasting, whether it's interests or the oration? Like, what is it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I count as a speechwriter. So I don't want to put myself in that bucket. I mean, you know, the sort of like, The two actual professions I've had in my life have been like research analyst and journalist. And those two are the ones that I think sort of like for me add up to like what makes my podcast my podcast. Mm-hmm. You know, first off, like I try to do a lot of research and like not come off like I'm sort of winging it when it comes to when it comes to doing a show. And believe mm-hmm. me, I've also asked like weird background questions about my guests from like 15 years ago about parts of their lives they've forgotten too. Just because I kind of think it's fun. You know, the journalism aspect of things is like, you know, writing, and maybe this comes with speech writing too, is like questions sound like you need to think about how questions sound, and I try to kind of get in and out as fast as I can with these doing these sorts of interviews as opposed to sort of like making the show about me. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, part of maybe like a speechwriter's creed is to like sort of be invisible because you're not the star, right? You're like writing in someone else's voice. So I definitely think like it's my voice that is on my show. But I do try to sort of like ground all the interviews in the sort of like understanding that I'm not the most interesting person on the episode. And if I am, then I did a bad job booking. And that like I want things to be sort of like well researched in order to like give the guests, you know, like respect for all the work that they've done, and also kind of bring out the most interesting corners of whatever research my guests have done.
This wasn't planned on my end, but it seems like an interesting moment I've just found myself, and I didn't think of the fact that you actually are. I was more thinking of in preparation for this, you know, Jordan and his knowledge on China, but I didn't even think long enough to think, well, Jordan's actually also interviewing a lot of people on podcasts as well. So it might be interesting to ask, you know, you said you're thinking about how the question sounds quite a bit, but you also want to get in and get out because you don't want the podcast to be about you. Can you reflect on that a little bit more?
That sounded fancier than like the idea I actually had in my head. Basically, like I remember like listening to, I had like a Tim Ferriss phase, and I fell out of the Tim Ferriss phase because I was like, man, this guy tells the same story over and over again. And I just never wanted that to be my show. Mm-hmm. And I always like, you know, he's talking to these like four-star generals and like CEOs of giant companies, and like 40% of the show is him. Like, he's not as cool as these people. Like, he's a guy who sort of like writes books and like is motivational, I guess. But there are all these other people who are like, you know, have done incredible things with their lives. And that was kind of my ethos. And I think with my questions, like, I don't want to use my questions as like a way to sort of show off. The only time I sort of do that is like to make sure that the guest knows I read the whole book, which oftentimes the, you know, 95% of the time when people are interviewing these authors, like the journalists have not read the entire book because, you know, they have 5 articles to write a week or what have you. Sure. But sort of once I do that once or twice, I really try to keep the question short and like allow the guests to take them in the direction that I think is most, that they think is sort of most interesting. I guess the other thing I like, the other sort of like tradecraft thing I've learned is just being more comfortable interrupting folks. And that kind of goes against my like original principle of not showing up too much, but like having listened, like, you know, not everyone is a guest on a show all that often. Not everyone speaks in paragraphs. And occasionally folks start repeating themselves, or like, you know, they reach a natural ending point, but then they like try to say something else, which is sort of off topic, and like making sure to like have the listener in mind, in that like hearing someone talk for like 7 minutes straight is like not a particularly easy way to kind of comprehend what they're saying, is something I've gotten more comfortable with over time, of like just, you know, jumping in and guest and saying like, no, actually, like, let me stop you there, and I'll sort of put you down a new path.
Wow, that's, I mean, I'm always so nervous to do that. Like, interrupting is hard. And as a listener as well to other podcasts, you quickly, at least as someone who's also producing podcasts, quickly get a sense for, oh, wow, why did he interrupt him there? Or why did he have to interject when he was on such a good point? That's a hard, what would you say, couple of balls to juggle.
Basically, whenever I like am tempted to open a new tab, that's sort of my cue for like, oh, if my mind's wandering, then like the audience's mind is probably wandering too. That's my like internal
barometer. That's a good way to do it, actually. Yeah. Well, with that in mind, let's go on to one of the next ones. So this was also a fascinating excerpt from your LinkedIn. And forgive me if this is also undersold as well, but I think it's kind of impossible that it is. So you spent almost 2 years at Bridgewater, which for those unaware is just like a very sort of, what would you say? It's got like a sort of cult fame-ish in the finance world. And it's Ray Dalio. That's the reason why. Much is made of Dalio's radical honesty policies and gives examples of people ranking ideas transparently to others whilst they're in the room in front of them and supposedly fostering an effective meritocracy of ideas. So I just wanted to ask you, because I've actually never met a person who's worked at the company, how much is this all embellished by his public persona, and what's it actually like to work inside of Bridgewater?
It's weird, man. You know, it's a unique experience. Like, yeah. I don't have like particularly negative things to say about the organization, and I think like I've also been in a lot. Like, it is intense, and you know, spending like being criticized like every single day is not a easy thing, and it doesn't work for a lot of people. And even within the people, even the people who sort of self-select into it, who Bridgewater screens that they think are most sort of useful, are most like attuned to this way of being, you know, they have very high turnover in the first year. I think there are some published stats about how like 30% of people within the first year end up leaving Bridgewater. So it's a really sort of unique thing. Just having everything be transparent and having you really be encouraged to like give honest and critical feedback all the time. And it really doesn't work for everyone. However, like I think most organizations probably err too far on the other side of like waiting for things to fester and not giving folks enough feedback in order for them to like, you know, actually progress and develop in as efficient a manner as possible. I do think there is something sort of unique about not only the culture, but also the business they're in that makes this sort of like managerial style work. Like the types of people who are into this, let me back up. So like betting on future, you know, bond yields and like what's going to happen to currencies is a very kind of like at a certain sense objective thing. You don't have to like worry how the customer is going to react. And the types of people who are like very good at like understanding their users or like, you know, working with clients or whatever, are also probably not the ones most wired to be like criticized every, like, you know, all the time. So, you know, it's an interesting thought experiment to think about sort of how broadly applicable it is. Like, Ray's idea is that like every organization should go whole hog, and if they're not sort of adopting all the principles, then they're losing it. But I really think that like by sort of leaning in all the way to the way Bridgewater does things, you end up like alienating like a large swath of people who are really good at a lot of things, that like the people who work inside of Bridgewater just aren't.
Where do you think they're lacking in that case? Where are they missing out on these people?
This isn't like a commentary on like Bridgewater as a firm. It was more like, look, if you want to run a good marketing campaign, like only accepting the, you know, 0.5% of like people who are okay being criticized all day, all the time, is not likely to give you the type of talent pool you need to do really good like customer research and like be really creative when it comes to like coming up with like, you know, marketing slogans or like a market entry strategy or what have you. There are just like sort of different, there are like people, a lot of people are different, and very few people, at least in the US, in, you know, the modern era are like comfortable with this sort of constant and aggressive feedback. I mean, it's interesting because like I have family who lives in Israel, and you know, that culture is a much more sort of open and direct one. Even if, you know, folks think Americans are open and direct, but like, you know, it's sort of apples and oranges compared to Israel. And, you know, there are lots of reasons for that, like everyone having gone through the army and sort of having that sort of shared lived experience is probably one of them. And you know, maybe sort of pulling only from like a group of, you know, sort of like saucy is not saucy, pulling from a group of, you know, like, you know, caustic Israelis might like raise the percentage of folks who'd be okay with you know, doing Bridgewater type management. But just like the way American society is, it is very much out of the mainstream, and like it's hard it requires a lot out of someone, more than just like a week-long sort of training program to get folks acclimated and like willing to go through with it to potentially reap the benefits of this sort of more aggressive and more constant feedback.
Mm. Yeah, I get the sense that the organization must select for such a uniform type of person. If you think of the Venn diagram of the best students, but then also that tiny little circle at the bottom of the type of personality type, which doesn't take things as personally, like sort of less open people. Yeah, you must be leaving so much on the table, I guess, but that's also part of the point. Before I move on from Bridgewater, though, I'd love for you to give an example. So you were there for almost 2 years, right? So just to give me and the listener a sense of what you're talking about, what is an example of this crazy radical honesty that they talk so much about?
You would go into meetings, and they have this thing called the like dot app. And as you are giving a presentation during a meeting, people are like giving you dots, which are sort of like, and this is now a public app, I think, like it's on the App Store or something, where you are sort of like given real-time feedback on people saying, oh, Jordan, like 7 out of 10, you made a good point there. Your creativity is a 7 out of 10. 4 out of 10, logical reasoning. Like what you said didn't make any sense. And that's happening in real time. And if you're sitting in a room and there's 20 people there, like you have a sort of, I think you have like a weekly quota of how many of these dots you need to like give. And, you know, it's kind of disconcerting. I mean, yeah, you know, definitely. For some, it could be disconcerting to like have that be something that you like have to engage with every time you have any sort of interaction.
Mm-hmm. And it's all transparent, right? So you can be like,
yeah, oh, yeah, you know who said it. You know, yeah, you can ask the person, you get the, you can say, you know, I want to understand more. All of that stuff is, it's very clear, sort of where it's coming from, you know, what caused it, when it happened. The other thing is like every meeting is recorded. So you can like even listen back to what happened to understand exactly what it was that wasn't logical that she said.
Mm. Yeah, it's such a fascinating way to sort of live the majority of your life. I mean, because if you are working there, it's the majority of your life, right? So your waking hours you spent in this kind of wild environment. How much posturing is there? So for example, if I'm up there and I'm giving some sort of present, I'm trying to pitch whatever, some investment in, opportunity, and people give me fours around the board. Can I then posture and be like, oh, you know what? Oh, I need to do better. Tell me, where could I improve? And people are sort of just posturing, but inside they're just thinking, and you can tell through however one can sort of tell when people are BSing, that they think that everyone else in the room is an idiot and their idea is actually the right one.
I mean, if that's your attitude, like if you don't buy into it, you'll leave. Because it becomes too much sort of emotional labor to like be like having this like double train of thought. And like, you know, maybe you can discount like 15% of it, but it ends up being like a fair amount of your day, sort of like wading through all of that and trying to process it and adjust accordingly. And if you think it's a waste of time and you think all your colleagues are idiots and not, and like, you know, you could be doing other things with your life, then sort of reflecting on what makes you unique and, you know, how your what impacts your performance or whatever, then you're just going to leave. Because, you know, A, there are other professional opportunities for the folks who end up at Bridgewater, and B, it's just like, you know, if you're gonna, like, you can make like the same amount of money, do the same sort of stuff at other places. Like, the reason you will stay at Bridgewater is because you actually get a real kick out of this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're in proximity to Ray Dalio and all that sort of stuff, I guess. Interesting you say people who are at Bridgewater could go and pursue actually what they were interested in more. It seems like you would probably fall into that bucket, because it was after your stint at Bridgewater that you turned your attention towards China, it looks like. Could you talk more about this move? Because presumably you had on at your doorstep any career move within the financial world that you really could have wanted to have taken since you were employed at Bridgewater.
Yeah, I mean, it was also, there's a few things to it. I mean, probably most like salient was the fact that I had a very severe concussion where I was like really not doing great for a long time. I was on medical leave for a better part of a year. And after that experience, I was just like, wow, I have my life back. I want to have a big adventure. So I think that was sort of like a pretty large driving factor in this. Also, I don't know. I've been interested in Asia for a long time. You know, at Bridgewater and at jobs beforehand, I would be sort of writing stuff about like the Chinese economy or like U.S.-China relations, and I didn't know anything about China. Like, I'd read like 5 books about China. I didn't speak Chinese, and I sort of thought that was silly. Figured it would be like a reasonable investment of a few years of my life. I was single. And then I got a letter saying I got free grad school for 2 years. So it was an easier decision than it seems like in retrospect, I guess. And just sounded like a interesting left turn adventure.
Interesting. So it was serendipitous, the fact that it became such a passion of yours. It was like pure chance. This wasn't this romanticization of China that you had for your whole life, and you were just waiting for an opportunity to do it.
No, I had a romanticization with living abroad, and between college and when I went to China, I counted it up at one point. I applied to 14 different fellowship programs. One I got accepted for in Egypt. But like the month after I got this job, like a revolution broke out, the counter revolution broke out. So I wasn't about to sort of go into like Egypt when like Morsi was shooting people in the streets. And then it was like 0-for-12 after that, applying. I kept like sort of going east. So I remember like there was a Fulbright to Chile. There was a Fulbright to India, Malaysia, Princeton in Asia, Loose Scholars, like another Fulbright to South Korea, I think. And China just happened to be the one that was like, okay, sure, we like you enough, Jordan. Come on down. So yeah, I mean, it was a bit of a happenstance thing. I think I would have been happy sort of anywhere that was like very different from the U.S.,
So you had a bit of the Fernwurm, this German untranslatable word that you just have it's a longing for distant places, an inexplicable longing for distant places, anywhere but where you are, almost.
Love it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well then, brilliant. So now we're in China, you've touched down, and I was hoping for you to explain the country to me and the viewer beyond the caricature that China is commonly understood. And that is, you know, bad air quality, sky rise buildings everywhere, 12 lane roads, homogenous flat culture, you know, racism against ethnic minorities, but then also strong family values, hard workers, crazy connoisseurs of food. Like, this is the caricature of China, right? So I would like for you to please open up on it and, if possible, explain it through your travels going to different places in the country.
Oh, wow. I don't know. What is China? China's really big. China contains multitudes. I think that was probably the biggest takeaway in just bopping around China over 2.5 years. I mean, it's it's so enormous, and there's like so much different inside of it. I mean, you sort of alluded to ethnic minorities, but like when you have like nearly 1.5 billion people, you have a lot of stuff going on, and anything from everything from like extreme rural poverty to first world cities, which like are arguably run better than New York, and have sort of like better infrastructure and more sort of like better like provision of resources. Mm. I mean, I think that's sort of like there are many sort of like central tensions in China, but I think the sort of like on the one hand, the sort of unity of everyone. At this, mostly everyone at this point speaking like standard Mandarin, while at the same time there's so much sort of like regional difference, and the kind of extent to which the CCP over the past 70 years has been able to sort of like flatten and homogenize that out, but doing that is kind of impossible, and the sort of variety of lives and cultures that exist within China is still real and pretty dramatic. So I think the sort of regional variation in sort of outlooks and lifestyles, even if 90% of the country is Han Chinese, is mm-hmm. something that I had very little appreciation of before I showed up in China. And then, you know, it's a one-party state, right? And that's a kind of weird thing for the 21st century. And it's not something I think you sort of end up bumping into like every minute of your life, aside from sort of the internet censorship, right? If you're a foreigner who like wants to get on Google and like has to log into their VPN every day to do that. You know, it does sort of like, it is a very unique governance system, and that means that a lot of sort of like Chinese life, the way cities are organized, the way sort of things are run, is different than it would be in a different country around the world. But I think it's important to emphasize for someone who hasn't spent a lot of time there, like how, you know, unless you're a Uyghur in Xinjiang, your daily life, unless you're a Uyghur in Xinjiang or like a activist, like a democracy activist or something, like the daily life for the majority of Chinese people is like relatively similar to what you would get in a you know, depending on your sort of like level of income, like what that level of income would get you in a democracy somewhere else around the world.
Mm. Interesting. So yeah, look, that's the kind of take I was hoping for. You know, you can sort of peer through the caricature, and at the end of the day, because of the variation in living standards, but in one of the main cities, it is quite comparable, right? To maybe not Stockholm, but probably even Stockholm. That's where I'm. I mean, or New York, like you say, London, so forth. Give an example of the regional variation that you just commented on, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. I mean, you know, it's just like, personalities, like people's personalities are very different. And like, there are these regional stereotypes of Northerners being more like fun loving and like drinking more and like being more chatty, and Southerners kind of being a little more sort of uptight and insular and like focused on money and less interested in culture. And, you know, sort of people in Chengdu and Sichuan, like living a more kind of relaxed, easy-go-lucky lifestyle. And, you know, once you have a kind of like baseline and can speak some Chinese, it is very funny just having conversations with people and seeing how, like, you know, there are, you know, these are like gross generalizations, but like the multiplicity of like what like makes people tick and what motivates people in different regions in China is pretty interesting and pretty dramatic, and not something I was expecting going into living there.
I'm just thinking if I want to ask more about maybe like the geography, because you say it's so big. I mean, could you actually, yeah, if you wouldn't mind, could you talk about traveling through the country? So what are some great tourist destinations you've been to, and if you could speak about them a little bit. And forgive me if it's a bit of a wet question.
Sure. No, that's fine.
I just think it's fascinating. You don't hear much about travel within this country.
Yeah. I mean, like, look, I'll skip like the Beijing, Shanghai, Shenzhen type stuff. My favorite city is Chengdu. Chengdu, which is a sort of interior city in Sichuan. The food is incredible. It's like, it's not quite as like 8-lane highway-y. It's like a little more walkable. They didn't destroy as much of their sort of smaller, there's like more low rise sort of walkable neighborhoods. Okay. And you just like, they eat out, folks like eat outside all the time and just like spend hours kind of chatting on the street. It's like an incredibly easy city to love. Probably, maybe the most unique place I went to was Qinghai, which is in Qinghai province, which is in the west of China, which used to be like Anmo. It used to be part of Tibet, like way back in the day, and it has a sizable sort of Tibetan minority, Muslim minority, and it was really remarkable, like going around and seeing all these like mosques and Tibetan monasteries, and alongside like a just unbelievable scenery, like driving 3 hours and like coming across like 8 biomes from like a desert to like a, you know, salty lake to mountains to, you know, to like a more wilderness landscape. I mean, that was just like gave me a sense of just how enormous this country is and how much it contains, like just the amount of diversity packed into this, like, one like pretty remote like fourth tier city and its environs was a really striking thing to get to experience.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. That's something I would absolutely love to do. I mean, yeah, China ranges, doesn't it, from a rainforest in the south to the Himalayan mountain range running across the southern border up until just the steppe in the east, and then the Gobi Desert in the north, and this giant coast in the east. Like, it is, you can get everything within that nation, can't you? It's really amazing.
Yeah, it's incredibly beautiful country.
Yeah. And do you feel, so like you said, there's almost 1.5 billion. I think the exact number they've calculated is like 1.38, but we can assume confidently between the two of us that
we'll get there.
Millions and millions and millions of people that aren't accounted for in those statistics. Do you still feel at parts of it, it's extremely unpopulated? Can you still, because there's, I think, also a caricature of China that one city bleeds into the next and you don't go hours of driving where you just see countryside. Can you still experience this in places in China?
Oh, of course. Totally. I mean, like, you know, the way the sort of Chinese, demographic distribution is, it's like very heavy populated along the coast, and then the more inland you get, the less dense it becomes. So yeah, there are totally like long, like you can definitely do like very long drives without encountering like urban populations. Yeah, even a billion and a half people spread across the landmass of China is not gonna give you sort of like high rises throughout. Yeah, like it's like a you know, like a SimCity map or something.
This is more a Chinese political question, political philosophy, I guess, almost. And you commented that it's interesting that China is a one-party state, right? And I had on recently a guest to the podcast who is a consultant on special economic zones, which, you know, famously in the Shenzhen and the East introduced China to the global market. It came through these special economic zones. But basically, in the context of talking about that, he argued that while China is led by the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, a political party that has communism in its name, it's not right to think of them as communists the way that we would associate communism with North Korea, Soviet Union, etc. We should instead think of China through the prism of the mandate of heaven. And just as another dynasty with Xi Jinping as the emperor instead of a communist regime. So I would love to ask you about the mandate of heaven and whether what I just said resonates with your understanding of the country at all.
No, that's absurd. This is 2021. There are no emperors. I mean, I think it's a Leninist party, and Mao like very consciously modeled the way the CCP is organized on like Stalin, like, you know, 1930s and 1940s Soviet Union. And that is, the key to understanding what makes the CCP tick. And yes, there have been sort of reforms and economic reforms in particular, which have changed how they've dealt with, how they've tried to deal with various, economic policies and going from a sort of like real statist economy to one where there's, 70% of the market, 70% of the economy is now not owned by the state. But at the end of the day, it's a Leninist system. The question of like, is the mandate of heaven's like, is she an emperor? Is the mandate of heaven matter? I think like, look, everyone sort of ends up falling into what they like everyone's mental models kind of fall back on what they're familiar with. And given that like every Chinese person grew up sort of studying all the emperors and understanding how that works, there is like, every once in a while people write an article about like all these things that she's doing and it's like, oh, he's like a new emperor. But I think it's like, it's a sort of weird, simplistic, like orientalizing thing. To think that like, oh, there are going to be some earthquakes and that's going to mean that like she's lost like the mandate of heaven and there's going to be a revolution. I mean, it's just, it seems there's a whole lot more going on in the CCP than like, what like the Song Dynasty emperor had to worry about. It's interesting, like the more sophisticated sort of take on that question is like, what about ruling sort of state and a landmass as long as China, as large as China, like ends up sort of leading leaders down similar paths of sort of like governance and like to what extent the tensions around like centralization and decentralization involved in ruling so many people, and sort of those themes are interesting ones to reflect on. I would recommend anyone who's interested in like a serious, like informed take on these sorts of questions to read.
I'd like to hear actually you explain a little bit more to help me understand and perhaps the listener how the country does in fact work then, because like you say, it was founded, it's a Leninist party, or at least an extension of a Leninist party. I'm not totally familiar with exactly what makes them a communistic state that is comparable to the way that the Soviet Union, for example, was.
Sure. So I think the key thing to sort of understand is that you have the Chinese Communist Party, which has, 20 million or so members. And then you have the Chinese state. And those two things are somewhat separate from each other. So like the Chinese government or the Chinese state has all these bureaucrats who are in charge of, land grants or whatever. And within every sort of government bureaucracy, you have party members who are in charge with like conducting campaigns, sort of pushing through sort of agendas of the CCP, and like kind of pushing them down and out through the Chinese state to make sure that like the Chinese state is doing what the party wants it to do. And that sort of model of like these party cadres kind of driving what's going on in government and society in corporations, and sort of the rest of the Chinese state like having to like sort of follow directions of the party, is something that Lenin came up with, of like a sort of leading cadre of elites and party members, which are going to be trusted with like holding the correct line and sort of pushing it out towards the rest of society, is something that sort of Mao internalized and the CCP in turn internalized. So I think that dynamic, the sort of interplay between the CCP and the Chinese government, is something which is like critical to sort of understanding and processing like what happens in China and how the sort of early Soviet Union roots, how the CCP's roots as like a party which was born like through Soviet guidance, ends up running the country the way it currently does.
How is it evolving then? How can we understand why it's still associated so closely with communism, the way it's understood. How is the way that China is practicing communism changing over time? How far is it removing itself from these Leninist roots that it started off with?
Sure. So, you know, Gorbachev comes into power, 1980. Soviet Union is not doing that great. And he decides to do both glasnost and perestroika, right? So he's sort of opening up both the sort of political discourse, having more open debate in public about, you know, how the state should be governed, while at the same time trying to do liberalization, economic liberalization, and open up sort of more market forces to what was a very sort of like calcified Soviet society. Didn't go so well for him and the CCCP, right? Deng flirted with that. So in the 80s, we had a strong commitment to Gaga Kaifeng, to reform and opening up. That was mostly along the vein of sort of economic reform and sort of opening up to market forces, allowing foreign investment for the first time in 25 years, starting to trade with other countries, allowing sort of people to like keep the benefits of their labor in a way that they couldn't for the entirety of Mao's rule. And you know, in the 80s, there was a sort of loosening of the strictures of society, and there was more open debate about what, how China should be ruled. Of course, this culminated in Tiananmen and the crackdown that came out of that. And the sort of takeaway of the late 80s and early 90s, of the fall of the Soviet Union and the sort of disillusion of the empire, by Deng and those who followed him, was that this is not the path that the CCP wanted to go down. So the sort of political, hints of political loosening, which you saw in the 80s in China, were sort of thrown out the window. And, you know, there's been sort of marginal, like relative tightening and loosening in the 2000s. You know, you had some experiments with sort of like village level democracy and whatnot, but there's been a very like clear commitment by the CCP since the 80s, back when the party was sort of really did a hard think about what it wanted to turn into post Mao, that political liberalization was not in the cards. And it's on the political side where you see many of the, you see a lot of the sort of like, I don't know, Soviet tendencies still in play. And even economically, like, there has been a ton of modernization, but the state still like directly runs 30% of the economy, which is a dramatic number, and something that, folks don't always appreciate. That a lot of these, these state-owned, the Chinese state-owned enterprises are like the largest companies in the world. They have like, enormous, like they sort of dominate entire industries in China, from sort of energy to oil and gas, to sort of some like ship manufacturing. A lot of car manufacturers are somewhat state-owned, and you sort of go down the list and you're like, wow, this is actually like a big chunk of what's going on in China that is still sort of directly run by the state. And, had China not had this sort of like Soviet Maoist legacy of there being no sort of private sector, you wouldn't have, you certainly wouldn't have that today.
No. Do you think that the 30% of the Chinese economy, which is state-owned and operated and ran, do you think that's likely to increase or continue to decrease, as it has from the 80s, decrease from whatever close to 100% it was down to now 30%? Is it still steadily going down? Like, is China moving towards more or less of state-controlled business, I suppose?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, like, on the one hand, there was some economist who like wrote a book in 2002 being like the retreat of the state, and then like in 2018 he published a book like The State is Back. So I think the trend lines have shifted on that in the Xi era for sure. You know, Xi is a real believer in the importance of sort of state-owned industry and state, you know, heavily the state being heavily involved in sort of key strategic industries. So I think that number has like basically been flat over the past decade or so, and where it was trending down pretty dramatically in the few decades before that. And you know, as long as she, I don't think she's going to have a change of heart anytime soon. So as long as he's still alive and kicking and you know, writing the 5-year plans, we are not necessarily going to see a real decrease in that in the importance of the state to the broader economy.
Fascinating. And all of the geopolitical follow-ups and natural questions that one would want to ask and think about when they think about China, just in the interest of time, I would urge the listener to go and subscribe to China Talk and then go through the annals there and have their questions answered. For example, questions about demography, questions about Evergrande, questions about Taiwan, questions about the Uyghurs, X, Y, and Z. And so instead ask you, what is the big question that you're grappling with when it comes to China? What is the most important thing that you're thinking about in the context of this country?
Ooh, good question. I mean, what happens if there's a financial crisis? I think is a really interesting and naughty one. you know, is Xi's sort of push to reintroduce the state into more and more of the private sector and tech firms in particular, like what impact is that going to have on sort of China's economic trajectory? What happens if Xi leaves? How could he leave? What are the sort of like potential possibilities with you know, with the future of the Xi era? You know, how is the world's going to respond to China? I think we've sort of seen a, you know, the Trump era was really weird. And in the sort of nearly a year now we've had, after Trump, like a lot of the planet is like still pretty upset with what, you know, what China is doing. And there's been a lot of sort of global coalescing around China as like a negative actor. So what does that mean? Like, is that going to continue? What does that mean for China? How tight are these sort of like, you know, bonds created by the fear of China, global bonds created by the fear of China going to develop into? Those are a few of them that I try to spend my time sort of like fruitlessly pondering.
Nice and naughty, as you said. Then I'd like to give you the chance to open up on the first of the big issues that you're thinking about, which is the potential financial crisis in China. This has become much more spoken of recently, I suppose. There's been a lot more attention that's been paid to the Chinese housing market, for example, and basically just, I'll let you take it from there. Could you open up on that first question that you're worrying about?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think I'm the right person to answer like whether or not it's going to happen. You know, let's say there's a 30% chance that you have a real credit crunch, given all the sort of like debt overhang and housing sector issues. You know, what does that mean for Xi's governance? Like, if growth like is like pretty dramatically slowed for the foreseeable future, does that mean he has to sort of change his priorities on where he wants to spend his money? You know, potentially away from all this sort of like semiconductor high tech stuff and more towards, you know, maintaining full employment and sort of bailing firms out, that sort of thing. What does it do for China's global standing if all of a sudden there's sort of like everyone, you know, the world ends up sort of realizing that like maybe China's like rise isn't quite as inevitable as folks have kind of been assuming for the past decade or so. You know, all really, really interesting outcomes. And I'm not like rooting for the Chinese economy to fall apart. Like, I think it's like not a great thing. Like, a lot of people will go through a lot of pain, by their sort of personal finances being wrecked by this sort of thing. But it's I think like the biggest sort of near-term variable which could change some of the trend lines that we're currently seeing in terms of sort of political and economic developments, is if the Chinese economy were to suffer a you know, reasonably dramatic slowdown.
Everything taken into account, do you have more of a bullish or bearish outlook for China, say 20 to 30 year worldview?
You're back. Okay. Bullish or bearish? I mean, we kind of have to like set a baseline. I guess like, I think the world is kind of building up China a little more than it should as like this like giant, scary, like unconquerable behemoth. Mm. So I guess like marginally bearish, but it's a tricky thing to kind of handicap. Because, you know, it's particularly like sort of like what the like global base case is, because I think a lot of people, there's like a lot of incentives from politicians around the world to kind of build up China to be a scarier thing than it actually is, in order for them to, you know, pass whatever legislation that they want, which is like ostensibly in response to China's rise. Sure. So that's a tricky one.
That comes to the end of the interview. So I'd like to leave you with the two questions that I have left every guest so far. And the first is, if you could pick one country in the world that you were very bullish on in the foreseeable future, who would they be and why?
Bullish on a country? I'm a huge fan of Mexico. I think it's just like
me too.
The most incredible place. I mean, speaking of sort of like the amount of sort of regional variety and the sort of like latent dynamism, untapped potential, all that stuff. I mean, like, I don't know a lot about Mexico, to be honest. I've probably read like 6 books on the country and spent, you know, maybe 6 weeks of my life there. Bullish in the sense of like, I hope to be spending more time traveling in Mexico. let's put it there. Yeah.
Nice one. That's actually the exact same country that I choose as well. Finally, Jordan, if you could witness a conversation, so listen to a podcast, between any two people of history, dead or alive, no language barrier, who would they be and why?
Well, I was like, I was on GPT-3 the other day. I was like making like Mao and Jesus have a conversation. I just like think that'd be really funny. I don't know. I don't know what Jesus would do with Mao. I don't think he'd have enough patience for him. He'd just be like, why is this guy killing so many people? Mao wouldn't have
much good stuff to say.
Yeah, I would pay a lot of money to see that. To see that one.
Nice one. Well, with that, I really appreciate your time, Jordan, and continue the good work.
All right. Thanks so much for having me on, Ryan.
Well, guys, I really hope you enjoyed that. You probably see what I prefaced at the beginning, maybe spending too much time talking about one thing rather than another. But nonetheless, if you've made it to this part of the chat, then I assume you enjoyed it at least a little bit. So thank you very much. I want to ask you to review the podcast, because it's really the only way that the podcast directories know that they should index it into the searchable charts. I want to corner the podcast market for eclectic curiosities in whatever country it is that you're listening in from. But to do that, the podcast needs to perform in the different podcast algorithms. Discoverability is really in the stone age. So give it a nice review, make it 5 stars, add a comment, say something nice. It would just really make all the difference in the world. And I cannot overstate how helpful it would be to me as well. So thanks for listening to this stage. If you're interested in Nassim Taleb, I have a dedicated podcast to the work of Nassim Taleb, risk, randomness, and so forth. So do check that out. Obviously, it's in the description. Finally, thanks for hanging around to this stage. You're an absolute legend. And what else can I say? Cheers. See you later.